Hello, and welcome back to another virtual podcast. Hi, it's Justine Harcourt de Tourville, Editor-in-Chief for Virtual, and I am back after a long hiatus, but super glad to be talking about VR once again. And today's guest is really an interesting person. Karen Palmer has really taken the storytelling art to a whole nother level using AI and using gaming techniques and neuroscience to boost the effect. And she's a tremendous artist with a tremendous story. And I hope you'll forgive me since I've been away from podcasting, maybe not the most fluent in my questions. So forgive me for getting back in the game, but do listen to Karen. I think she can give you some really important insight into how an artist thinks and getting inspiration from other sources. All right, have a listen. Thanks. Hello, I'm Justine Harcourt de Tourville, and I'm really excited today to speak with Karen Palmer, who is a multidisciplinary immersive filmmaker. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct, Justine. That's a really cool name, by the way. It sounds like you're part of Marie Antoinette's crew or something from the Resistance
or
something.
That ran away 200 years ago to the United States.
Oh God, you need to run somewhere else now, right?
Well, actually, our family made a detour to England. So, and then we ended up in the lovely United States.
Oh, so you did. You are part of that crew then?
Kind of. I mean, we went through Normandy into the UK. So
you were on the
who knows?
You were on
we
the
could
run.
Be cousins.
Yeah, you were definitely on the run, Justine from the guillotine. My kind of official title is storyteller from the future. That's why this.
Well, I like that.
Yeah,
I think anybody working in immersive should adopt that because that's completely what we're doing. One of the things that's exciting to talk about is the work that you've did that you're known for, which is Riot. Mm-hmm. And perhaps you'd like to share a little bit about what that is or how it came about and what you hope to accomplish through the film or experience.
Okay, so I created Riot in 2016, which was inspired for me by the Ferguson riots that I saw happening earlier, and I was really affected by that and how the media was portraying it and the kind of the murder of Michael Brown. And there was lots of other riots happening, like in Baton Rouge and other areas, due to police brutality. And I wanted to put people in the middle of a riot environment so that they could kind of get a more of a gut feeling of that experience as opposed to the perspective being portrayed by the media. So I created an immersive experience that watches you back using artificial intelligence and facial recognition, where depending on how you respond to the film will branch in real time. So if you respond to, say, a riot cop with anger, then the narrative will branch in real time differently than if you will respond with calm or fear. And the objective was to kind of make people, one of the many objectives was to make people conscious of their subconscious behavior, because what they were perceiving on TV or in social media, I want to put them in that situation and make them aware of how they would actually respond within a high conflict environment like that.
And to date, most of the time people can experience this. How is it through, are they able to get it on their headset? Do they have to see it at an exhibition? How are you able to interact with this piece?
So the Riot is a live site installation piece, which means it's not something you can download. So you would normally go and watch it at a film conference like the Future of Storytelling Conference in New York, or a museum like the V&A in London, or the Museum of Modern Art in Peru. It would kind of be on tour all around the world, and it has been from Canada to so many places all over the world. So at the moment, it's not being exhibited because anywhere, well, it probably is, but there's nobody looking at it. It's probably in some dusty museum somewhere waiting for people to come in. So yeah, that's a live site installation. I'm moving towards, with my current work, I'm working on live site installation, but also obviously mobile iterations to kind of adapt to the world that we're now in and going to be in for a little hot minute.
It looks like that. And, you know, that's a fascinating piece. I relate to it as an American, obviously, very distressed with the riots that are going on. I mean, you have a first level, first of all, the fact that it was only through some kind of digital technology that was even making us aware of Michael Brown's story in the first place. But then to add that second layer of what somebody slant in the storytelling made it problematic. And then the idea of riots being negatively viewed when it was certainly a call for social justice. How are you seeing in current iterations the need for this, especially with the riots currently happening in the United States? How do you see this helping or deflecting or potential uses that you'd like to see?
Okay, that's an interesting question. So being the storyteller from the future, I'm kind of preempting things which are going to come. And so right. The Riot Project is very current, relevant, hits a nerve for now. But I kind of did it in 2016. Like Martin Luther King says, the riot is the voice of the unheard, is kind of to set the kind of tone. At that time, people have said to me, hey, this is a great bias, empathy kind of machine that you could use it, for example, to train cops and see if they are, how biased they are. And it was quite deep because people would tell me that when cops are trained, that they are trained when they're in these kind of high conflict situations, they respond from a certain part of their brain. Like, I think it's the front, like the cognitive part of their brain. But when they're actually in a real life situation, they're responding from their subconscious. And that's what my experience is targeting. So there was a lot of interest and discussion around that. But at the end of the day, as an artist, I'm not building like a product for distribution and sale. I kept my kind of development going of this journey. So I feel that writes very much of its time, preempting what's coming. And then last year I did another project called Perception.io. which was very much about the future of law enforcement and how it's going to be AI-based. And how, if it's AI-based and when it's AI-based, it's going to be fueled by bias because it will be just baked into the system. And that came out last year and was a commission by Cooper Hewitt, Smithsonian Design Museum in New York. And that was a prerequisite to defund the police. Because when they talk about defunding the police, what are they going to replace them with? They're not going to replace them with lots of like black and brown looking people patrolling the streets to save the community. They're going to replace them with automated networks. And that is going to be designed by the same people who are in power at the moment. So that was the Perception.io kind of a prerequisite to what's happening now. So the project I'm creating at this moment, which is a concept about hacking the future, that is where I'm at now. Like, we have to be part of building our own narrative for the future, because at the moment we're not. We're just kind of like sitting in the auditorium, watching the show go by, eating the popcorn, saying, wow, this is a really bad show, but I'm not going to leave the auditorium. I'm not going to get up on the stage. I'm not going to talk to the person projecting it. I'm just going to sit here and like we're captive. And that's not really the case. We are part of this narrative and we need to be conscious and aware and be activated to have agency so that we can not just be part of it, but that we can create our own roles within it. We can create our own journey that we could see ourselves as a person in this narrative who has a role and a purpose.
You know, that is definitely storytelling of the future or what needs to happen, certainly because so much is told for us and we're made helpless as an audience. And so it sounds everyone who's listening to this podcast already understands the beauty of immersive and empathy. But what do you think this as an art form is doing, and how is it venturing a little further than the typical thing? Because I heard you talk earlier a little bit about the gaming element. So maybe by, if you can share some of the reasons or thought process by bringing the functions of gaming into your work.
I have spent the last like 6 months kind of interrogating myself, asking what is the role of art and artists at a time of great conflict and in the times we're living. And my personal conclusion, which is of everybody has their own opinion on this, is that I need to make people aware that we are co-creators of our own reality. Because with art, anything you do which is art or artistic or creative, you're contributing to a reality. Say, you know, someone's bought this lovely MacBook Pro, so then everybody that I'm with, that someone had this idea for a MacBook Pro, and now I'm talking on a MacBook Pro with you. I have glasses here. Someone had an idea for that. You know, there's all different things around us, and it was a concept at one time that people thought, you know, I'm going to make this a reality. Nothing is here like accidentally. So as an artist, I'm contributing to that vision. If I was to make a track and then people were to go sing it, and then that would go into their subconscious and it would become a mantra, and they would probably not even realize what they may be singing, but it just becomes part of their psyche. If I make fashion, because I'm like thinking how, you know, this is how I see the world. I see it very loose. I see it very relaxed. Maybe I make jogging pants. People will wear those clothing and then they'll start to move in that way, as opposed to when people were, say, more restricted in the Victorian times. So everything that is artistic and creative is a contribution to creating a reality. And I need people to realize that they are co-creators of this reality. We are creating this reality together. The future is not something that happens to us, it's something which we create together. And I need people to stop acquiescing, because you're in this game or you're going to lose the game. You know, you're not even showing up. So, yeah. So that's my thoughts as an artist, to kind of, at the moment, my main focus with my current work is to activate agency in the participants to my piece. Yeah, at a time where we've never felt more helpless and hopeless. And the beginning part of that is that I make you conscious of your subconscious behavior to enable you to move through fear. So I am not an empathy chick at all. Empathy is not my thing. My thing is about moving through fear. Because to me, empathy is about you understand and relate to how I feel. That's really nice. That's not helping me though. And I want you to kind of own your fear and move through it, because that is directly affecting me. Fear is a very active emotion. What I find, empathy is a very passive emotion personally. So my thing is about...
So it's feeling versus action is what you're
yeah,
saying.
Yeah, but let's feel the feeling first. To me, the most dominant emotion, like if you were to say to somebody, oh, you know, you hate your job, why don't you leave? Or why don't you leave that guy or stop hanging out with that chick? Oh, I'm scared this might happen, or maybe this might happen. No one talks about, oh yeah, I'm not doing this thing because I'm not empathetic enough. It's not to me a motivating force. But fear is one of the most motivating forces in the world. My perception is that, you know, with what's happening with Trump, is that he's a great person to weaponize fear. He's a master. You know, he's not weaponizing empathy, right? That it's directly, yeah, it's fear. And he's harnessing that, directing it. And it's so super powerful. So my thing is that I'm not looking at you to empathize with me. All I'm looking for you is to move you through your personal shit, which is your fear, and I'll move through my personal shit, which is my fear, and we'll meet in the middle. So we need to take control as opposed to pointing the finger at people. So that is the big part piece of my work that I'm working on at the moment, which is called Consensus Gentium. And to answer your second part of the question, I use gaming dynamics, but it's really about interactivity and responsiveness. So I don't use VR headsets or stuff, so hopefully I'm still allowed to be in this conference. But I use kind of films that watch you back. So you watch a film, but the film watches you back through a webcam. So you're kind of immersed in like a room which has a huge projector and you're watching a film taking up most of the wall. So your brain and your emotions are the joystick. You don't press something. So that's how it responds and reacts to you. And that's how I use gaming, is that I'm not asking you to press a button. That's way too primitive. Why would you be doing that? Do you want exercise in your fingers? I want you to kind of become aware of how you might respond in a situation and then be like, oh shit, I didn't know that triggered me in that way. Let me go into the experience again and learn how to move through that emotion and then intentionally reprogram the neurological pathways in my brain. So that is my role as an artist. I have no doubt about it. I'm very clear in what I'm doing. I've been focusing on this path for the past few years, and that's my objective. And the thing is, it's kind of like an inverse of media and marketing. There's people like Edward Bernays who created... if you heard of him, you must have heard, yeah, Edward Bernays. So maybe not. So he was...
I don't. So please elaborate for anyone else.
Yeah,
I'm
sure you do, but nobody else does. So Edward Bernays was the nephew of Freud, and he worked with Roosevelt in the war, the Second World War, and he did a lot of the propaganda that you'd see in the cinemas. And after war, he was like, wow, look at the impact of all this stuff I did, my videos. He's like, you know what? We should continue this throughout peacetime, but propaganda is a bit of a dangerous world. We'll call it public relations. And that from that, that became the basis of advertising. And things like getting women to smoke came out of some of their direct marketing campaigns. And it wasn't, they kind of sold it as we're making women independent. You're equal to men, you can smoke. But really, they just wanted to tap into that untapped market. So it's highly, highly manipulative. And it's based upon connecting with people's subconscious. So I became aware of this like about a year ago. Someone was like, hey, do you know this guy, what he did? Because you're kind of using that same knowledge for good. I was like, no, I didn't. Let me just check this out. And I was like, yeah, we're kind of being manipulated and exploited by this kind of expertise all around us. I didn't even know that. And now I'm flipping the script that I'm using the same techniques to empower you.
Well, I'm trying to see, how I situate myself, because there was certainly a lot of... dastardly goals there. I believe they employed anthropologists to help dig into the kind of human behavior that would drive the kind of manipulation that they were seeking. Certainly it was a bad time, but what you're really talking about is the notion of taking things that are invisible subconsciously accepting and making them visible.
Yes.
And that's kind of interesting. And it seems like either a very, very, very good linear storyteller can do that, but more impressively is somebody that interacts with their audience is able to do that. And I was watching pieces of Riot just in the video. I was able to see where people were presented with these three choices or not presented with a choice, but it was measuring their anger or there were two others.
For anger, fear, and calm.
And calm, yeah. And just by measuring those, it would direct the police officer into a certain kind of reaction. We don't have that with linear storytelling.
Yeah.
So I'm curious what other elements, if there are any, that differentiate it from storytelling in general, basic, general, three-act.
Just building on, I had this branching narrative concept is that I then have to go and shoot three different narratives for each part. And then I have to build the tech. So the tech is a huge component of what I do, that when your face kind of looks scared, that will then send a signal to the technology to then branch, go to this branch, not that branch, in exact real time. So,
wow.
Yeah. And so that creates, and also the artificial intelligence systems which I use are completely bespoke. Like you can buy off the shelf systems like Watson and stuff like that from IBM. But as an artist, a research based artist, I was like, well, what's the point of that? I'm also trying to have an understanding of these systems through working with technologists to build them. So I work closely with Brunel University in London, and then ThoughtWorks in New York City. And through creating these systems, I had a deep insight. So when we worked with the technologists in New York and they built this library of expressions to say, well, is this person angry? Are they calm? Are they fearful? The first question the technologists asked, well, who's watching? Who's going to make that decision? Who's going to label the emotions? Because say if I did it as a white chick, that may be different to maybe if I got a law enforcement officer and he was watching pictures of a black person, that maybe they might think what someone's fearful, they're actually aggressive and angry. So who are making these decisions? So through creating these systems, we asked ourselves those questions and we then wondered, are people who are creating these systems having these same conversations or are they just labeling them? And that's, so creating the tech, to go back to answering your question, is a fundamental aspect of what I do, because I'm exploring many of the themes that are going to become prevalent in the world moving forward. Like the first riot was about ethics of and making people aware of facial recognition technology, which is very much inserted into a surveillance kind of state. And at the time, I spoke a lot about China and their credit system. But when I do talks now, I don't talk to China's like, forget China. It's the UK, it's Australia, it's America in the name of COVID, this kind of introduction of this hyper surveillance grid, which isn't really gonna go anywhere. With Perception.io, I was looking at bias in networks specifically. And that was looking at how, because we built those systems, we could understand how bias is created and perpetuated. And in the current project, Perception.io, it's very much about making people aware about this surveillance and the kind of, but also it's not just about the system that's there, it's about finding the answer of how we are going to not just resist this, but successfully overcome. So... So how are we going to do that? Tell us quick before the election. So I spent the last 6 months in R&D for my project Consensus Gentium, which is commissioned by the BFI and working with my amazing producer Tuwe Huynh to develop a series of Hack the Future labs. I brought together thought leaders from around the world and activists to see how we could hack the future. So, and I went to two different countries to do that. Well, one country. I went to the UK and Netherlands because we have experts all over the world. We were supposed to go to America, Detroit, but we didn't quite get there before things started to get a bit gnarly. So but basically I had people who are experts. So I had like an anarchist author like Christian Williams, and I had who wrote the book The Enemies in Blue about the origins of the police are based in white supremacy and slavery. Yep. I mean, when they say the system doesn't work, hell no, the system does work perfectly well based upon its origins and what it's there to do. Because, for example, origins of police is that they originated from slavery patrols where people used to, overseers used to go out and catch the slaves. That you can, he tied that back directly to it. So then you go, of course they're gonna.
Well, we've got of prisons. Course that makes sense. I mean, we've got prisons, the industrial complex as labor, you know, free, cheap labor. I mean, there's all sorts of ways, you know, even schools are. You know, industrial factories,
pipeline, yeah. Schools to prison.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of unpacking that you're talking about that we just have to kind of, you know, think about. I'm curious though, because the skills that you talked about, the kind of technology stack that you're thinking of, the bespoke technology that they're talking about. Wow, that's beyond a normal storytelling,
It is, right?
Yeah, beyond the usual. I got the multidisciplinary. I started understanding, oh, that's why. How did you, tell me a little bit about your background, about how you started, because you identified yourself first off as an artist, and then I knew about the immersive, but wow, what a package with that kind of AI cred there. So you want to give us a little bit of background about how you came to find and discover these, great sectors.
So I'll start at the end. That I, to be honest, I It is a lot. And if I'd consciously, I didn't stumble into it. I was very deliberate, but my God, it is really hardcore. The depth of the tech where I go with it, I it's almost made my hair go totally gray. Like, wow, it's so specialist and niche. But I started as a fine artist, actually. That's what I studied at university. And then I wanted my kind, and then I was a painter, and then I started taking pictures because I wanted to capture reality more. And I wanted my pictures to walk and talk. So I started to move into being a filmmaker. And then seriously, like 15 years ago, like just after 2000, I was working in film and directing and shorts and stuff. And I was like, hold on a second, this is not the future. The future is going to have technology integrated with storytelling, because people are not going to be passive observers. They're going to want to be part of a responsive experience. And then I spent the next 5 years kind of exploring that and just figuring out how that would look. And then at the same time, I started doing...
How did you go about that, Karen? I mean, that's fascinating, because you're talking about 2005 that you're thinking, okay, stories are no longer going to be a passive experience. In 2005, you're thinking about that and you're spending 5 years. Tell me a little bit about that process, about how you went from making a realization as an artist and saying, okay, we're going in a new future direction. What do I need to do?
Yeah. So I just kind of, you just have to honestly just connect with yourself. It's not like, because I had like quite at that time, like a real high flying career in the music industry. And I was like, this is just not what I'm supposed to be doing with my life. Like, this is just not the one. And I was doing really well. Like, I had a really nice BMW. I was buying like Christian Dior. I was like living life. I was like, wow, this is so superficial. This is like really not where it's at. And it took me a while to kind of unravel myself from that psychologically and then go, what should I be doing in my life? Like, I have a purpose here, something much bigger than just selling products and marketing for people. And I started to kind of just like play with media a little bit more in my own time. And I also started doing parkour around that time. Are you familiar with parkour?
Is that the cool thing where guys and girls, yeah. I say mainly guys because I usually see guys in like hip hop athletic leisure wear running up buildings and jumping from roofs and doing somersaults. Is this?
Yeah, it's that.
You're
it's
doing that, parkour?
It's more... Yeah, I'm a free runner. I'm a bit injured. I've been injured for a while, but I'm very committed to it. And I did it completely for like 2 years nonstop, like 6 days a week, 2-3 hours a day. Like, we were like, basically I reprogrammed my brain to move through fear. And so that inspired me to kind of leave my job and figure out what the hell I'm supposed to be doing with my life. And then once you kind of got the will, you're kind of trying, and then you might see, oh, there's a little course over there. Arts Council course on new forms of storytelling. And then you jump on that and you're like, okay, that's not bad. That's weird. That's interesting. That's new. And you just keep moving, bouncing around and till you find that thing. And I think because 2012, I was commissioned as part of the culture lead up to the Olympics to create an immersive film experience. But I had done two prior. So I probably ended up doing my first one in 2010 and the one before that in 2008. And I was probably spent a couple of years just trying to figure out what the hell I'm trying to do, how am I going to do it, and talking to people. And I remember as well, I went on this course that was like really weird, and it was like, I didn't even know what it was, but the description was weird, and I jumped on it, and it was this guy, people came over from the Netherlands, and they were bringing this new form of technology, and we had to bring our film, and it was really crazy. And I remember I spent 3 hours trying to get this thing to work, and then we got it to work at the last minute. I was like, wow. And I was totally hooked. Like, I don't know what the hell that thing was, but it was like art and tech and storytelling, and it was like a platform and a program. And then I met that guy who created that program. Acquainted myself with him last year, and he was like, wow, yeah, when I met you like over a decade ago, I could see that you were trying to search for things. And he's got quite a high position now, because sometimes when you're it's not a simple path like, hey, I'm going to do storytelling and immersive storytelling. You know, it's changed, that word's changed so many times from transmedia to interactive. I just knew that it was over there somewhere and I needed to head over there. That was all I needed to know. And then, you know, there's other people like him that are like, yeah, I need to head over there. And you can't even really define it. It's just like we're doing something a bit different to everybody else. And then like 15 years later, I'm like more established in my shit. And this guy's like the head of the new institute in the Netherlands. And it's like, yeah, you kind of, sometimes you can't even put a word on things. You can't describe what it is. You just know the direction you need to move in. And then you'll come across other people. So it's just about having the will. Because at that time, it wasn't even like a thing, you know, that you could say.
Oh, I mean, that's really interesting. So you're almost like chasing a vibe or chasing a guess or a, I mean, there's a little bit of daring. It's not clear cut.
No, I wouldn't know.
It's not like you're getting a PhD.
No, and even my dad's still now, how are you going to get a PhD? I'm like, no, I don't want to get a PhD, Dad. Like, that's not for me, you know, like that's not... I'm very clear of the moving through fear is a big part of it because I am, and having the commitment. It's like doing the parkour. Like, I know it's over there somewhere. I know that's like where my end destination. And I just have to start. Sometimes you can't overthink things because you're like, well, where am I going exactly? What clothes should I put on? It might rain. It might be too hot. Just move. Just start. Just go. Just begin. Just act, you know? And, that's just what I was committed to, the getting there. And it requires moving through fear. But what's the option? Like, well, I talk about it in terms of parkour terms, that when you're on a ledge in parkour, you've got to decide to take a jump or not take a jump. And even whether it's, let's not say it's too high. Let's just say it's high enough that you could kind of maybe, you know, hurt yourself a little bit to begin with, right? No, actually, let's say it's high. Let's say it's a high one, that, but you believe you could do it, but if you fell, you might break your leg, right? So then you're like, okay, I feel I could do it. So you're like, okay, let me go down and do that, practice that jump on the ground because I know I can do it. So let me just go down on the ground. Then you go up like half the level. It's a bit scary, but you know you can do it on the ground. But then when you go up to, say, the first story or the second story, you're like, wow, this is scary, but the distance hasn't changed. The only thing that's changed is your perception and your fear has kicked in. So what you then do is that you would then train yourself to do it at the smaller level, the medium level, and gradually get up to the higher level. And that's what it's about. It's just being committed and finding a way. The worst thing you can do, though, there's two things that are the alternatives to that. One, you don't attempt the jump and you just go away. And the other one is you just stay on the wall. So if you stay on the wall, then you're kind of paralyzed and that could be your life, like staying on the wall. And if you go away, you didn't really learn how to overcome your fear. You just was like, I can't do it. So parkour kind of taught me how to break down my cognitive thinking and that enabled the route to get where I'm going. Because it was no coincidence that I broke from my career at the same time I started doing parkour. Because I was doing jumps that if I fell, I would have broken my legs. And I'm like, well, if I want to leave my job, what's the worst thing that can happen? I did a jump yesterday. I didn't break my legs. So that's not the worst thing that can happen. I know I can, it's worth taking the chance.
Wow, that's amazing. To me, the big jump for the I mean, for filmmakers, especially immersive filmmakers, when they have to do so much fundraising, that's their jump, basically, is about getting that kind of money, being responsible for that kind of money in order to fulfill your artistic goals.
That's not the jump.
Really?
The jump is, in my experience, the jump is believing that you can do it.
Ah, all right. I stand corrected.
And then your commitment to seeing it through.
Well, but still, I think...
That's the cycle.
Don't you think it's still, as an artist... You're exposing yourself. Okay, there's the fear of being rejected or your work tanking or not being successful.
No, I don't care about that. Okay. I don't care about any of that. I believe in what I'm doing. I know what I'm doing is valuable and I know it's going to change people's lives. So I have no doubt whatsoever.
Well, there you go. I think that relates again to your parkour assessment. Can I make the jump or not make the jump?
Yeah, and also rejection, that's part of life. You know, there was where I had the year in 2017 where my whole world shifted, where I started, things really changed for me. Because I 2016, I started to see myself as an international artist. I didn't feel that the UK was the place for what I was doing. And 2016, I really put myself on like a global platform, because Riot came out in 2016 as well. And it was like, the interest was so international. It wasn't so much in the UK for many, many reasons. And I did a lot. I think I remember the first half of 2017, I applied. And I'm not really an application person, but I hadn't really developed my speaking career at that time. So applications is not my strength. So the first half of the year, I applied for 40 things to get into. And then I applied for 2 in the summer. And I was like, it's my time now, because I've got so many rejections. Like, I was kind of going for like 100. And I was like, by the time it hits 50, somebody's got to say yes. And what happened, by the time it hit 50, 2 people said yes. And they were the TED residency in New York, and they were ThoughtWorks residency. And so rejection is like part of life. And if you don't think that, you're kind of on the wrong planet, because nobody's just going to get up, and that's just going to be how it works. And just I want to tell you another story as well, quickly, about belief. So I was doing quite a bit of training at that time, and well, a good, like, enough, 2016, 2017. And I did the interview for ThoughtWorks, technology company. I love that company, and one of my favorite companies in the world in New York. And I did the interview, and it was one of the worst interviews I ever did. I got shortlisted for the residency because I was contacting the Fire Center in Canada, setting up Riot remotely. I was doing it in my lunch break, and I was like, what are you doing? Like, your brain is so frazzled talking to technologists for 3 hours, and you're doing an interview and then talking back to technologists in Canada remote. Like, this is the worst idea you ever had in your whole life. But that was the only slot they had for me. And then I did the interview, and halfway through, I was like, this is the worst interview ever. I'm never going to get this residency. And then that was a Thursday. And then Thursday evening, I planned to go parkour. So I went to parkour, and they gave us a hardcore session. A guy called Blaine. He goes, we're going to do 100 jumps today. And we're going to, And we're going to break it into 10 sets of 10. And that, so he showed us like something to do, like we're going to jump to a wall, then climb up the wall. It wasn't even like a jump. It was like, you're going to jump from the steps to the wall, then climb up the wall, jump down the other side, come back and join the queue. And that was like number one. And then it was like, you're going to jump from this wall to this rail. You know, it got progressively worse, right? And the halfway through, I was like, I'm literally going to physically die, but I'm going to die doing what I love. And then we got to the end of the session, and I distinctly remember laying on the floor. And I think I just managed 93, which is not good for me. But I was like, I physically could not do anymore. I was laying on the floor, totally out of breath, convinced I was going to die and needed to call a doctor. And I was like, I couldn't have tried any harder. And I went home feeling good and satisfied. And the next morning, I was in the shower and I was like, you know what? I haven't got that feeling about the interview. I could have tried harder. So I just, without thinking about it, I got up and I remember I put the towel around me. I sat on the computer and I just wrote an email. I felt I could have tried harder with the interview. And you asked me this question, this question, this question. My brain was distracted. And this is how I would like to answer these questions now. I'm sorry for this unorthodox, but I feel that if I hadn't emailed you, I wouldn't have tried as hard as I could try. That was a Friday morning. On Monday, they emailed me and they said, I got the residency because of the email.
Oh, wow. What a great story. Yeah. And thank you, Karen. This has been phenomenal, phenomenal stories you had and in just a podcast conversation.
But I was just saying that because it's about belief. Who cares about, of course, when getting the money is the easy part.
Yeah, but you added
compared to believing in. I believed in myself so that I made an opportunity. I believed so much in myself that they believed in me.
No, but you added that extra layer.
And then from that starts another journey.
You had that extra important layer of, did I do my best? That's the issue. And I think that's what we need to ask ourselves. Are we doing our best?
Oh my God. People, if they were to sit down and watch in the news with what's happening with Trump and Biden and just ask themselves, you know, am I doing my best? Is there anything else I can do?
Yes.
I think a lot of people turn off the TV and just get up and start doing something.
Well,
And it doesn't always involve social media, for God's sake, as well. It can involve like getting out there and connecting with other humans. Even in a time of a pandemic, you can still connect with human beings.
Exactly. I think that's the fundamental question. Belief is essential because, you know, you don't try if you don't have belief. But the you know, whether we're viewing something, whether we're making something, whether having conversations, am I doing my best is I think the core question. So, you know, thank you for that. I think that's very inspirational, even without trying. So again, Karen, thank you so much for talking to us today on virtual. We love to hear from exciting, you know, fascinating filmmakers like yourself, an artist and technologist and multidisciplinary, if I could ever say that. So thanks so much for sharing. And we look forward to seeing, and tell us again what the new work you're working on is called.
Oh yeah. It's called Consensus Gentium, which is Latin for if everybody believes it, it must be true. So it's about perception and reality. And I've just finished my R&D, which is called Hack the Future Labs. So it will be a series of immersive pods, which are or digital experiences where people from the future will be coming back to give you a message warning you of what is to come.
Wow. Can't wait. When will that be coming out approximately? Like, and through what?
Yeah, so there'll be the first experience, because there's going to be a trilogy of them. The prototype will be available in March. And that will be a live site installation and a mobile iteration. And then the second version should be done later next in the year. And then the third version, the third film, the year after.
Well, that's fantastic. Something to look forward to. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Justine.